Black History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nishad Carrington. Now, this week we have a person of interest that is near and dear to my heart for numerous reasons. First, as many of you may know or have gathered through some things that I may have said, I've played the game of baseball from the time I was 4 years old until I was a senior in college. Second, I was a pitcher. So that position and much of the strategy of the game is ingrained in my mind. Third, I don't believe I've ever mentioned this before, but in addition to a few other things that I do, I also coach high school baseball in the St. Louis area. And we actually just started our season this past month, so baseball's on my mind almost daily, 24 hours a day. I'm either thinking about baseball, at a game, at practice, whatever it may be. Baseball's on my mind, basically. And finally, fourth, I really just remember as a child, my godfather actually telling me about how he had the privilege, and yeah, I will more than willingly call it a privilege, to see this particular person play the game when he was a child. It actually described the infamous Ephus pitch that this person threw. Now, don't worry if you didn't catch that. We're actually going to touch on the Ephus and a few of his other kind of famous pitches a little bit more in a second. And finally, I actually wanted to just kind of switch gears a little bit from the topics that we've been covering, most pressingly the last episode with the Congolese Holocaust, and cover something that isn't necessarily gruesome and not necessarily a down point in the diaspora, but instead is just kind of a neutral point. You know, when it's something that's still kind of shrouded in mystery and, you know, in my opinion, a little bit of disappointment, but also triumph and most crucially, longevity. So Leroy Robert Page was born somewhere around July 7th, what we believe to have been 1906 in Mobile, Alabama. I say somewhere around July 7th and also what we believe to have been 1906 because for most, if not all, of his public life, there was a running gag that no one ever knew just how old he was. This is actually kind of important later on, so just hang on to that year in mind, 1906. Anyway, so he was born as the seventh of 12 children to his father John and his mother Lula. When he was a child, his father worked as a gardener and his mother as a washerwoman and a caretaker. So this is to say he didn't quite grow up in abject poverty, but they certainly weren't wealthy. And he surely would have understood and known the power of hard work. And being in Alabama at the turn of the century would have faced levels of racism and bigotry that we today know little to nothing of. The Page children, all 12 of them, understood one thing, as I'm sure you can understand and sympathize with as well. Money and resources in the Page household were scarce, with that many people to be taken care of. And what the children understood was that by about the age of 6, they actually too had a responsibility to help put food on the table and in some instances shoes on their feet. Now, Leroy actually started off by scouring local alleyways and cashing in the empty bottles he'd find on the street. He would also deliver ice, but, you know, both of those things actually only brought in little amounts of change. And he was growing at such a ridiculous pace that the expectations of his parents and the rest of his family of his earning capacity grew just as well. According to the legend, that was actually explained by Leroy himself. His mother sent him to earn money as a child carrying luggage for businessmen at the local train station to nearby hotels. But he wasn't happy with the little money that he was earning carrying a bag at a time, usually for about a dime per bag. So he eventually, using a little bit of ingenuity, rigged a pole and a rope to make himself able to carry multiple bags at a time, thereby earning more money. And according to Leroy, one of his co-workers would remark about his invention, saying, quote, "You look like a walking satchel tree," end quote. And that is where his infamous nickname was derived. From there on, he'd be better known as Leroy Satchel Page. For your reference, for the remainder of this episode, I will refer to him as Satchel Page and not Leroy, so please don't get confused as to who I'm referring to. Satchel Page. About 2 weeks before his 12th birthday, he had a little visit from the police and ended up being enrolled at a reform school after being convicted of petty theft and truancy. The charges actually stem from the fact that he was rarely ever in school, obviously obviating the truancy charge, but the petty theft was from his role at the train station, where he in fact stopped pulling bags but instead started rifling through them and taking things out and grabbing other things that were relatively easy to swipe from the nearby areas. Now, this stop at the Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers in Mount Meigs, Alabama, might have been the actual beginning for the activity in the sport that he is best known for, baseball. When he was at the Alabama Reform School, the school's baseball coach, Edward Byrd, noticed a few attributes about Satchel that he very quickly realized could be developed and honed. At 12, now Satchel hadn't reached his full-grown height, but Byrd could already see that Satchel had large hands, big feet, and a long, lanky frame, and saw that Satchel might make one hell of a baseball player. So you might be asking, what is it that made his large hands and large feet, as well as large, lanky, tall figure, attractive to Byrd for baseball development? Well, let's fast forward just a bit. Satchel would eventually grow to be 6'4", and while many don't realize it, height is a premium in any number of sports. I'm sure most listeners would understand the necessity and desire for height in basketball. There is a reason there are so few Muggsy Bogues in the NBA, as well as the desire for height in football, as there are so few sub 6'4" offensive linemen, and receivers are so often 6 foot and above. Well, would it surprise you if I said that the average height of a Major League Baseball player is about 6'2". So I just want to put this in a little bit more perspective for you. And if I'm boring you with this part, then bear with me and indulge me for just a second. The average height for a man in the United States is about 5'9". Okay. Now, 14 Major League Baseball teams don't have a pitcher under 6 foot. And my favorite team, the New York Yankees, have only one pitcher under 6'2" and 5 pitchers on their roster that are 6'7" or taller. Now, that's crazy to think, for me at least, that baseball is dominated by giants. But as I played baseball most of my life, I've always understood that height is looked at as a premium, especially for a pitcher, because of a couple of things. First, the appearance of dominance on the pitcher's mound. Since the mound is already supposed to be 10 inches tall, you grab a pitcher who's over 6 foot, and you're basically talking about somebody who's standing 7 feet off of the ground. Two, the distance of stride that taller people can generally generate when throwing the ball to the catcher, meaning they have a release point that is closer to home plate, can surely have an impact if your pitcher has a good and lively fastball to go along with their height. Finally, the fact that it's always better to have height is simply that pitchers throw downhill from a 10-inch mound. And it's generally believed that the taller a pitcher is, the more force they can generate coming downhill off the mound. So anyway, considering that Satchel would grow to be 6'4", he would have been one hell of a baseball prospect even to the present day, which this fact is important as we drive through the rest of this story. Like I said, Satchel was at the Alabama Reform School. Byrd taught him to pull back, kick his leg really high in the air, and as he was coming back forward, to throw his hand and arm forward to generate maximum force and power as he released the ball. Satchel would go on later to say, quote, "You might say I traded 5 years of freedom to learn how to pitch," end quote. At the time, Satchel was already over 6 foot tall, and he weighed barely 140 pounds. Almost like rail thin, actually, with him often joking later in his life that he was so thin that if he stood sideways, you wouldn't have been able to see him. Now, according to the legend, Satchel's hands were so big that they made a baseball look like a golf ball. And this is surely beneficial for a pitcher, as it allows a certain enhanced ability to manipulate a ball. The way that Byrd would teach Satchel to pitch would make him stand out, not only in the Reform School, but throughout his career as well. But it wasn't just the physical that Byrd would teach Satchel about the game. Satchel would also learn and become a master at outwitting his opponent. Key to understanding this was essentially understanding the body language of a batter. Byrd would teach Satchel that the easiest way to learn weaknesses of another is to watch his knees, similar to the same way that a bullfighter would study a bull. Watch the feet, watch the stance, check the positioning of the bat, then put the ball where the batter can't hit it. According to the legend, Satchel was better than anyone else who had ever come through the reform school before, but in all honesty, it wasn't his accuracy or his finesse. He just in general threw so much harder than anyone else had ever seen. But you have to remember, at this point, he is just learning his way and he's really just developing his unique style. At the time, he wasn't throwing a curveball, he wasn't throwing a slider, no changeups, not yet. He legitimately just blew batters away with his velocity. He was wild and untamed, but when he let the ball go, it basically looked like a cannon coming from his hand. So somewhere along the way, Satchel is actually released from the Alabama Reform School for Negro Lawbreakers, and this right here might actually be a good spot for us to take a break and grab a word from our sponsor, so be right there, and we'll be right back.
The Notorious VAG. Finally, a publication for women, by women. Do you have questions about your health and you're too embarrassed to phone a friend? Do you wish your doctor would make house calls? Or are you just curious for more knowledge about your own body? The Notorious VAG.com is here to answer all of those questions and more. Written by Dr. T, a respected female obstetrician and gynecologist, the Notorious VAG will entertain you with tales straight from the exam room while informing you and dispelling the countless myths that exist about our female nether regions. So, if you're ready to be empowered with knowledge about your own health, visit thenotoriousvag.com today. And be sure to subscribe to get our semi-weekly posts. Again, that's thenotoriousvag.com, and follow us on Twitter at NotoriousVAGDRT, a publication for women, by women, empowering women.
Welcome back to the show. When we left you, Satchel Paige was just being released from the Alabama Reform School, so right here it might be necessary to give a bit of a backdrop to the game of baseball and the effects of segregation and racism on the game. Now, Major League Baseball as we know it today was formed in 1903, but the American League was actually formed in 1901 and the National League was formed in 1876. Now, I won't get deep into the sordid details, but in the 1860s, partially due to the Civil War, a New York style of baseball expanded to the national scene and grew to be the first governing body, named the National Association of Baseball Players. At the time, this group existed as an amateur league for about 12 years, and because of the Civil War, most of the strongest clubs were in the northeastern United States. Now, the very first professional baseball team was formed in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1869, and it was called the Cincinnati Red Stockings. So let's touch on the National Association of Baseball Players for a quick second. In 1867, this organization actually determined that only whites could uphold the gentlemanly character of amateur baseball, arguing that excluding black players would prevent racial resentment and avoid a rupture on political grounds. Rather than following the rules of the association, professional baseball teams valued winning games more than underscoring racial differences and continued to sign contracts with black ball players. In 1872, in fact, a professional team in Newcastle, Pennsylvania signed John Bud Fowler to play second base. Fowler was the first black man to play professional baseball. I will say that one more time, and I will touch on it a little more in a minute, but I will say this one more time. John Bud Fowler was the first black man to play professional baseball, but Moses Fleetwood Walker was the first to play in the major leagues when Toledo of the American Association signed him as a catcher in 1883. But then in 1887, the team owners decided that they had had enough, actually, of black players in the league. And that year, a white player on the Syracuse team of the International League refused to pose for a team picture because a black player was his teammate. In response to this one sole, solitary person, the International League owners decided to discontinue signing black players, though they would not terminate the contracts of players that had already been signed to the various teams. Following the ruling of the International League, the manager of the Chicago White Sox, Adrian Anson, refused to let his team play an exhibition game against Newark, New Jersey, because the Newark team had planned to start a black player named George Stovey, a black pitcher. Later that same year, Anson assisted in the prevention of Stovey being signed to the New York Giants, and major league owners didn't share the sentiments of allowing already signed players to remain on rosters, and instead, by the end of the 1880s, had actually released all of their African-American players and all agreed to not sign any more contracts with black players. The league would be completely segregated by 1889. Now, because of the deals that major league teams had in place, black players began to form their own professional leagues and teams in the late 1880s. The first black club ever formed was the Cuban Giants in 1885 by Frank Thompson, who was then the head waiter of the Argyle Hotel in Babylon, Long Island. Now, the team was mainly comprised of Argyle's wait staff at the hotel, and they chose the name Cuban Giants because they believed that they would be better respected by the public if the general public didn't think they were Americans. In 1887, the League of Colored Baseball Clubs organized with teams in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, Pittsburgh, Norfolk, Cincinnati, Baltimore, and Louisville. The league would fold within a year, but in small pockets and vestiges around the country, the spirit of black baseball leagues would continue through the years, with the Cuban Giants dominating the game through the 1890s. So that's a little bit of a background of the Negro Leagues, which wasn't much of history per se, but just some background for thought. So keep that in mind as we move forward with Satchel Paige. Now, I want to pause here for a really, really quick second just to give you a little bit more information with regards to the Negro Leagues. Something I want to clear up with regards to a misnomer. As a matter of fact, this is not even in my show notes. I just thought about it as we're going forward. I just want to kind of clear this piece up. So you'll hear Negro Leagues with an S at the end of that. Not Negro League solitary, but Negro Leagues with an S, plural. I just want to clear up a misnomer in saying that the Negro Leagues was not one league. It was not like Major League Baseball, MLB, that we see today. It was multiple leagues all around the country, okay? So there were little pockets of black baseball being played all over the U.S., and it was not one league that they traveled all over the country. It was a bunch of little leagues, and that actually, in fact, made up the Negro Leagues with an S. Now back to Satchel Paige. After leaving the reform school, Satchel Paige would return home and join the black semi-professional Mobile Tigers. At this time, Satchel would say, quote, "I gave up kids baseball just for fun, and started baseball as a career," end quote. Playing for the Tigers in the 1924 season, Satchel Paige would win an estimated 30 games and have only one loss. He would play semi-pro for one more season and move on in 1926 to join the Chattanooga Black Lookouts for two seasons. Over the next several years, he would go from team to team, seeking out the highest paycheck, but also progressing to better and better ball clubs. Over the course of some years, he would play for the Birmingham Black Barons, the Baltimore Black Sox, the Cleveland Cubs, the Pittsburgh Crawfords, the Kansas City Monarchs, the New York Black Yankees, and the Memphis Red Sox. Now, when he wasn't playing on a particular team, Satchel Paige and other black players in the Negro Leagues would form freelance barnstorming teams that would tour the country playing other teams, both professional and amateur, in exhibition games to make extra money. Now, Satchel Paige would primarily barnstorm with Dempsey Hovland's Caribbean Kings. So right here, you may ask, what is this term barnstorming that I just referenced? Well, barnstorming is basically where teams and players would travel to various locations, usually being smaller markets or country rural towns, to just stage exhibition games. So barnstorming teams would differ from travel teams because they would operate outside the framework of a traditional athletic league, while travel teams are designed to operate in the framework within a league. Barnstorming was exceptionally common in the Negro Leagues, as players would often barnstorm before, during, and after league regular seasons. Barnstorming is nowhere near as common today as it once was. I can assume any number of reasons as to why that could be the case, but for a more modern day reference, we have the Harlem Globetrotters. So, barnstorming was actually never easy on the players. While the games would pay them additional money, the problems were actually multi-layered. The hours of touring were long, and the time away from family and friends was harsh. Satchel Paige and his wife were not different in the suffering, but more so that the distance from family and friends was the fact that players regularly endured racist taunts from spectators due to segregation. They were not allowed to stay at hotels where whites lodged or even dine at restaurants used by whites, but Satchel Paige did things just a little bit different and took a stand. He, in fact, refused to play in towns where he could not get a hotel room or a meal. We mentioned his wife. Well, on October 26, 1934, Satchel Paige married Janet Howard. In 1940, he married Lucy Luz Marie Figueroa in 1940 while he was playing baseball in Puerto Rico. At the time of marrying Figueroa, he hadn't yet, in fact, divorced Janet Howard, so the marriage to Figueroa wasn't legal. He would finally divorce Howard in 1943, but then he would later go on to marry a woman named Lahoma Brown, and the two of them would then have seven children. I know I breezed through his family life really fast, so I apologize if you get offended at that, but this kind of episode is all about baseball and his family life while he was definitely active. It's kind of a small story. His family's really not mentioned a whole lot until we get to the end of his life. But Satchel knew that, you know, not only his talent, but also his entertainment value. When he was on the field, he could attract a very diverse clientele and definitely included white patrons as well. He was more than capable of amazing spectators with an array of pitches and gave them all catchy, colorful names like the Ephus I mentioned before, which was one of his famous pitches, the jump ball, the B ball, the screw ball, the wobbly ball, the whipsy dipsy do, the hurry up ball, the nothing ball, and the bat dodger. Ever the showman, Satchel Paige used his arsenal of pitches to confuse batters. He wasn't afraid to sidearm the ball across the plate, follow that up with a blazing fastball, and then throw his signature hesitation pitch, where he would pause in the middle of his windup, effectively serving to mess up batter timing. Now, in 1938, while he was playing baseball in Mexico, I told you that man would barnstorm, but he was also not afraid to go overseas to play as well. While he was in Mexico, Satchel Paige injured his pitching arm. At what Well, guess was the age of 32, they thought his pitching career was over, and Satchel was only really known as a pitcher. It was a bit shocking when J.L. Wilkinson, owner of the Kansas City Monarchs, went on to sign Satchel to play first base for the Monarchs' second-string team, the Kansas City Travelers. Though it appears as though his pitching career was over, he somehow recovered the following year and joined the Monarchs back in his pitching role. As he got older, the control he developed surely was what would make him to be actually the most effective as a pitcher. After coming back as a pitcher to the Monarchs, Satchel would pitch them to four consecutive Negro American League championships that was capped with a clean sweep of the very powerful Homestead Grays in the 1942 World Series, where Satchel would win three games himself. After that World Series win, the Monarchs team got very, very weak, and Satchel dropped to an 8-10 record in 1943, and then in 1944, he only pitched in a total of eight league games and had a record of 4-2. By the 1946 season, he was back to his normal dominant self and helped to pitch the Monarchs to their fifth league championship in his time with the team. In addition to a couple Negro World Series wins, Satchel Paige pitched in five East-West All-Star games and was credited with two wins in the same game. But here's the thing. I'd like to think that you've gotten the gist that Satchel played everywhere and not only around the country and in different leagues, but also in the Caribbean and Mexico as well. Well, also in that time, he played on the West Coast of the United States, and the league rules out that way were much different than the racist ones of the South and the East Coast. That being said, when playing on the West Coast, Satchel had the opportunity to play against major white professional ball players of the time, including Joe DiMaggio and Babe Herman, with both of them saying that Satchel Paige was the toughest pitcher they had ever faced in their careers. So we touched on the racism that segregated baseball, but what about the moves that brought black players into the major leagues? Now, I'm sure everyone knows the name Jackie Robinson and has that name emblazoned in their mind as the person who broke the color barrier for Major League Baseball. We actually mentioned two other names earlier that played, that both actually played professional baseball before Robinson, Fowler and Stovey. But there are there were actually numerous black players in the various professional baseball leagues. But anywho, in 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first black player to play in the 20th century. I'll say that again. Jackie Robinson was the first black player to play in the 20th century professional baseball. Remember, the league was segregated by 1880s. I don't mean or want to diminish the legacy of Robinson in any way, but that surely is a caveat that needs to be made in the history books for us to fully understand black baseball in this country and the fact that the Negro Leagues was not the first time that black men had played baseball. But there are numerous reasons that Jackie Robinson was selected to be the first in the 20th century. But Satchel Paige would have this to say in his autobiography. Quote, "I'd been the guy who started all that big talk about letting us in the big time. I'd been the one who opened up Major League parks to colored teams. I'd been the one who the white boys wanted to barnstorm against. It still was me that ought to have been first." End quote. Now, at the age of 41, but again, we'll never know this for sure, Satchel Paige was definitely viewed by many as being too old to play in the major leagues. But in the span of his career, Satchel estimates that he pitched 2,600 games, had 300 shutouts, and threw 55 no-hitters. So I'm sure you might be thinking this episode is about over at this point, but in all actuality, it's not. This is actually a prime time for us to pause again and take another word from our sponsor of the show, and we will be back in just a second.
Are you an emerging artist? Are you concerned about your community's issues? Do you understand your innate ability to engage the masses through art?
Sensitize works to assist artists in reaching their highest potential. Through creating and implementing community projects with emerging artists, Sensitize aims to engage the masses in developing solutions to underserved community issues.
Contact Sensitize for more information.
So 1 year after Jackie Robinson actually signed with the Brooklyn Dodgers, on July 7th, 1948, Satchel Paige was signed to a contract with the Cleveland Indians after Bill Veeck signed him to a deal. At the time, though again we can't specify his age, Satchel Paige was the oldest rookie ever to play Major League Baseball. So I'm sure you all have understood very well at this point, there is no actual ability at any time to tell Satchel Paige's age. I've said it repeatedly, but that's the reason this episode is subtitled A Timeless Talent. In his rookie season, Satchel Paige posted an impressive 6-1 record with a 2.48 earned run average, and down the stretch helped the Indians to win not only the American League pennant, but most importantly, the World Series as well. In the World Series, Satchel would become the first African-American pitcher to pitch in the World Series when he got the opportunity to pitch 2/3 of an inning in Game 5 against the Boston Braves. He would play for the Indians again in 1949 and then spent 3 seasons in St. Louis, playing for the then St. Louis Browns. Ever being the showman in the 1951 season, Satchel was playing with the Browns and would often be seen relaxing in his very own personal rocking chair that he had at the stadium when he wasn't playing, just to keep the legend of his ancientness alive. He would go on to make the Major League All-Star Game in the 1952 and 1953 seasons, but somehow after making the All-Star Game in 2 seasons, he would actually return to the minor leagues and back to barnstorming for years before returning to the majors 12 years later, at what we are to assume would be the ripe young age of 59. He would actually pitch 3 innings for the Kansas City A's in 1965 to become the oldest man to pitch in a Major League Baseball game. In order to qualify for his Major League pension, he would briefly join the Atlanta Braves in 1968 as a pitching coach. If there's anybody who's qualified to be a pitching coach, I'd have to feel like it's probably Satchel Paige. Now, in 1971, Satchel Paige was inducted into the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, and by doing so would become the first player elected to the Hall of Fame from the Negro Leagues. Satchel Paige had numerous quotes, but one of his most famous and probably the most of a testament to his timeless nature was, quote, "Don't look back, something might be gaining on you," end quote. But most importantly, I'm sure many of you will remember that the late, great Aaliyah said, age ain't nothing but a number. Well, Satchel had his own feelings to that as well. And he would say, age is a question of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. Now, Satchel's last few years were quiet ones, and too quiet for this man, actually, who adored being on the mound in the middle of all the action. Satchel last appeared in public on June 5th, 1982 in Kansas City, where he had actually spent most of his adult years and with his wife, Lahoma, raised 7 children. The roar was gone from his voice as he wheeled closer to the microphone, an oxygen tube strapped to his face while his hand gripped a baseball. He said, quote, I hope the next time you come out, I can stand up. He said that hopefully as the thin crowd stood in his honor, they were actually dedicating, in his name, a baseball stadium near his home. The ballpark was as decrepit as the old baseball player was, with weeds poking through fresh-cut grass and wind pouring through breaches in the grandstand roof. Friends who knew his condition had rushed to organize the naming ceremony, hoping it would, you know, help to lift his spirits. But it would take more than that. He would say, quote, I'm honored with the stadium being named after me. I thought there was nothing left for me. I've been in Kansas City 46 years, and I can walk down the street, and people don't know me. 2 days later, Kansas City was battered by a rainstorm that actually felled trees and knocked out power. Satchel would wake up in the middle of the night with a headache. The next morning, the 8th of June, he could not find a comfortable position to lie in or sit in. His shoulder was throbbing. He had the chills. His wife, Lahoma, would apply a hot water bottle and draped her jacket around him. Then she headed to the store for ice to keep food from spoiling during the outage. While she was gone, Carolyn, their second oldest child, actually found Satchel in a bit of a daze. She fanned him, calling, Daddy, Daddy, can you hear me? All he could manage was a ugh. His daughters called the paramedics, but their arrival was delayed, of course, by a fallen tree from the storm. In the meantime, Lahoma had got home and tried to resuscitate Satchel using CPR she had learned while she was a nurse's aide. He was limp as a dish rag, according to her. His heart gave out for good in the ambulance, and he was pronounced dead at 1:15 p.m. at Truman Medical Center. In the days just before he knew he was going to pass on, his wife would say, he would try and not talk about it. Unfortunately, Satchel Paige would pass away from a heart attack, again on June 8th, 1982, in the city where he spent much of his Negro League career, Kansas City, Missouri. If you're interested in seeing the final resting place of Satchel Paige, he is interred at Forest Hill Memorial Park Cemetery in Kansas City, Missouri. Now, here's the thing, and I do believe no matter the research you come across, it will reign very, very true. Since much of his 43-year career was spent in the Negro Leagues, it's very difficult to document and properly catalog his total lifetime career stats, because record keeping in the Negro Leagues is spotty at best. But one thing surely is clear. He had respect across his peer group, white and black. He's regarded hands down as being one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history. The best records we can put together from his time in the Negro Leagues is a 103-61 record, with 1,231 strikes to only 253 base on balls. So we say repeatedly that he was one of the best pitchers, but that record isn't pretty enough to really relay it. So let me put it in a little bit of perspective here. The record definitely underestimates his dominance because he wasn't used in a normal or a conventional way. As he was the best draw in the Negro Leagues, he would quite often start games, but might leave the game after only 3 or 4 innings, which, if you know how baseball stats work, you'll know that that's enough time for a pitcher to be credited with a loss, but it's not enough time to be credited with a win. These records also won't include his barnstorming games that he played in for more than 40 years against sandlotters, semi-pros, and big league ball players from California to the Caribbean, or even playing for a team in Bismarck, North Dakota, where he managed to go 35-2 over 2 seasons. Now, I previously gave you the quotes from Joe DiMaggio and Babe Herman, but in addition, the legendary Boston Red Sox hitter Ted Williams said, quote, Paige was the greatest pitcher in baseball. St. Louis Cardinals pitcher and pro legend Dizzy Dean would say, quote, he's a better pitcher than I ever hoped to be. And Hall of Famer Buck Leonard would say, he threw fire. But here it is. Though the Negro Leagues didn't keep great records, and though there are numerous appearances missing from the official records, legend has it that Satchel always knew his performance and records. In fact, he supposedly kept a notebook over the life of his career listing his innings pitched, the game scores, who the opponent was, his strikeouts, base on balls, and according to a sports writer who allegedly saw the notebook, he also kept the item most important to him, his take-home pay from the gate each time he played as well. Now, according to Page's notebook, he pitched in more than 2,500 games and won approximately 2,000 of them or so. He supposedly pitched for 250 teams and threw 250 shutouts. Also, according to his records, his per-game strikeout record was 22, which would actually be the all-time record for all of baseball. And his other claims would show 50 no-hitters, 29 starts in 1 month, 21 straight wins, and throwing 62 consecutive scoreless innings, throwing 153 appearances in 1 year, and even scoring three wins. Even three wins in 1 day. Now, if that's correct, then that is pretty damn impressive. We can see that it was more than his memorable pitching form that made Satchel stand apart and earned him a cherished spot, not just in the Hall of Fame, but in a Satchel statue that now graces the Negro League Hall of Fame grounds. There was also his role as a racial pioneer, a role that got lost in his showmanship and bluster. Satchel pitched spectacularly during the era of segregated baseball, especially when his teams were beating the best of the white big leaguers, that white sports writers turned out to watch black baseball. He proved that black fans would fill ballparks, even when those parks had concrete seats and makeshift walls, and that white fans would turn out to see the black superstars as well. He barnstormed here and in the Caribbean alongside Dizzy Dean, Bob Feller, and other Caucasian champions, winning them over to him and to the notion that the Negro Leaguers could really play ball. He drew the spotlight first to himself, then to his Kansas City Monarchs team, and inevitably to the Monarchs' rookie second baseman Jackie Robinson. The truth is that Satchel Paige had been hacking away at baseball's color barrier decades before the world got to know Jackie Robinson. Satchel laid the groundwork for Jackie the way A. Philip Randolph, W.E.B. Du Bois, and other early civil rights leaders did for Martin Luther King Jr. Paige was as much a poster boy for black baseball as Louis Satchmo Armstrong was for black music and Paul Robeson was for the black stage. And much as those two became symbols for their art in addition to their race, so Satchel was known not as a great black pitcher, but a great pitcher. In the process, Satchel Paige, more than anyone, opened to blacks the national pastime and forever changed his sport and this nation. So there it is, Leroy Satchel Paige in a nutshell. And I think we have a few instances of history that you would find more than interesting and that I believe you might find a great deal of enjoyment in doing a bit of independent research on, including the Negro Leagues, Jackie Robinson, and even a person I don't believe was mentioned but would be well worth your investigation, Josh Gibson. Now, Josh Gibson supposedly hit more home runs than Babe Ruth and supposedly hit a ball over 600 feet. Like, he was very, very talented while also being a little troubled. He was very, very talented, and so I encourage you wholeheartedly. I know you've heard of Jackie Robinson. I know you've heard of the Negro Leagues, but if you haven't, do some research on Josh Gibson, G-I-B-S-O-N. But I'll tell you, there is one thing we mentioned that I do believe has a story all in its own, and I'm sure has passed history and time without its just due, but plays a major role in the life of Satchel Paige. The Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers. In fact, without giving away too much of the tragedy surrounding it, there's actually a book written about the terrible instances of sexual abuse, beatings, and hard labor that was inflicted upon the children who were supposed to have been helped during their time at the Reform School. Now, obviously from the place's name, Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers, you can tell what children were sent to this reform school. Now, the book was written by a man named Dennis Abbott, who was a probation officer for juveniles in Montgomery County, Alabama in the 1960s, and part of his job actually was to transport black youth to the reform school at Mount Meigs. Anyway, in the event you have an interest in exploring the stories of abuse that took place at the reform school and really kind of how the vestiges of abuse as inflicted from the juvenile justice department onto African American youths has kind of, you know, been, if nothing else, washed under time. I definitely encourage you to pick up that book. Again, the book is by Dennis Abbott, and it's called They Had No Voice, My Fight for Alabama's Forgotten Children. I'll say that title again. The author's name is Dennis Abbott. The book is They Had No Voice, My Fight for Alabama's Forgotten Children. Now, again, you know, we haven't reached out to Dennis Abbott. As a matter of fact, I don't believe he's still living or his publisher or anything. This is a completely unsolicited, you know, promotion for the book. It tells an amazing story, unfortunately, an unfortunate amazing story. So I actually wholeheartedly encourage you to visit the Negro League Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, as well as the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. A couple of years ago, I actually had the ability to meet the curator for the Negro League Baseball Museum, and he was an amazingly wonderful guy, very insightful. He knew more about baseball than anybody I've ever met, I think, especially the history. But moving on, I do believe we have a little bit of listener mail to read to you today, and this one actually comes from a man named Peter Odule in Dayton, Ohio. Peter, I apologize if I messed up your last name. Please forgive. So it says, quote, "Hi, I love your podcast and have been loving learning all of this history, much of which I've never heard of. I particularly love the episodes about Seneca Village and the Yellow Rose. I'm a grad student at a PWI where I also completed my undergraduate degree, and I have to say it is so nice to have this podcast to rely on when I'm feeling particularly overwhelmed with the whiteness of this campus, both literally and figuratively. Please keep this going. It's helping to provide so many Black people some inspiration. I wanted to know, what is the origin of the image you use for the podcast?" So Peter, again, thank you for writing in. I don't believe we actually got an opportunity to respond to you directly, but please allow me to respond to you now. I hope you're hearing this episode. So the image for the podcast, I've actually got a couple of questions about this from both friends, family, and obviously from Peter. So I'm sure he's not the only one who's wondering. The image for the podcast is actually Black Wall Street. Years and years ago, if you ever Google Black Wall Street, or if you just search for images of it, there was apparently a collective image that was taken of some of the bankers, lawyers, doctors, many of the professional individuals from the Tulsa, Oklahoma, Greenwood area. And so our production staff here just kind of superimposed a picture of the Unity flag, as you probably remember from our episode on Marcus Garvey. A picture of the Unity flag over top of the image of Black Wall Street. The inspiration behind it, I'm sure you can probably figure on your own. However, the inspiration behind that is just the strength and empowerment of Greenwood, you know, the Tulsa area and Black Wall Street, as well as the unity that's imparted by that flag. So I hope that answers your question. Again, thank you for listening. You know, I know that it can be a little overwhelming sometimes when you are in a majority-minority environment. But, you know, I'm glad to hear that this podcast actually gives you a lot of inspiration, and I hope it does to any and everyone else. So we're at the end of our podcast episode today. But before we go, I want to encourage any college students out there to keep on the lookout in the coming days and weeks. We are actually going to be doing a little bit of recruiting. We actually have partnered with LookSharp, a company out there for interns. I believe they also run Intern Match. We are seeking interns. In the event you are, or you know a college student who is interested in interning in broadcasting and research and getting a bit of professional experience, feel free to have them reach out to us directly at info@thisiscarrington.com, or be on the lookout in the coming weeks for more information and specifics regarding the positions. Now, I know we have, like I said, we have already teamed up with LookSharp. I know we do have a position that's posted up there. It is a very general one. Feel free to apply through there, or encourage any college student who you know who fits the criteria as well to apply through there. You know, we do have kind of an open enrollment. We would love to just get interested kids who, you know, love the topic and love the information. In closing, I truly hope that you enjoy this episode and learn something interesting, especially about Satchel Paige. Like I said, I know that you probably know about Jackie Robinson, but, you know, Satchel Paige was his own, he's special in his own right. So be sure each week to check us out for new and updated topics. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, feel free to check out our website at www.blackhistorypodcast.com, or email us. Again, that email address is info at this@carrington.com. Send us your feedback as well, suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspectives to an episode we've done, we will make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to future episodes. Please, as we take this journey together, we will do our best, as I feel like we do each and every time, to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some occasional commentary presented. But if you come across any errors or mistakes, please let us know. Because as always, we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and we'll see you next time.